Haru, who I think I haven't seen for 30 years, perhaps, something of this order, and Raphael. Pleasure to be here again. I was here for a few days last week. So very active place, lots of things to talk about. So I'm going to talk about, well, Neil said I could talk about anything I wanted, but I thought that would, that's always a dangerous thing to say to a speaker, right? So I do want to talk about basically the effects of the conformal anomaly in four dimensions, which I think are very interesting for a number of reasons, cosmology, scale of gravitational waves. Here are some of the papers. So I hope to get to that. But since this is a workshop on geometries, functional integration of geometry, I think I should say a few words, which I think will mesh a bit with what Claudia said this morning. So this is an outline. I'm sure I won't get through it all, but let's just start with the covariant functional integral and see how it relates to the conformal anomaly, which is where I want to go. So there's a completely alternative method than the one Claudio outlined this morning. And of course, the right way to do it, I would say, is to start, as he did, with the phase space measure and to derive properly the constraints. But there is an alternative way, which looks actually quite nice and geometrical. And as far as I know, that's due to Polyakov, although it probably has some antecedents. So if you look in the book on gauge fields and strings, he describes this. And what we did was to adapt it to four-dimensional gravity. So the idea is you want to integrate over metrics. So think of the space of metrics as the analog of a Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian manifold with some coordinates x. This is the correspondence. So you want to define a one form or a member of the tangent space or cotangent space of at the coordinate x. That's the small deformations of the metric, which I'll call h. And in ordinary Riemannian geometry, you have a line element, which is bilinear in the small in the tangent space indices, tangent space one forms, and that therefore should correspond to a Gaussian, to a quadratic form in a product on the space of deformations of the metric. And here appears some kind of supermetric, which also appeared in the 3+1 split that Claudio discussed this morning. So we'll come back to what that is. But it clearly has. Sorry?
We're in four dimensions.
Yeah, this is four dimensions. I can write in any dimension, actually. So I'll write some formulas which are D dependent. But here, I just reverted by habit to four. So it's convenient to introduce the Fierbein notation so that I can write a local tangent flat space metric, eta. E is then the determinant of this, which is the square root of minus g. And I'll also introduce a density, h tilde, for the metric perturbations. And then you can just easily find that the inner product looks like this, okay, where g, if it's going to be ultra-local and not involve derivatives of fields, which essentially would introduce other dynamics, then it has to have this form, symmetric. And basically, the only tensors you can write down is this symmetrized one of this form and the one which takes the trace part, where this can be an arbitrary constant, and we have to fix that constant by some principle. But just covariance fixes this form. So what you want to define now is the integral over on this cotangent space, which I write in this bracket form. And of course, this is some poorly defined product over these metric variables, tensor variables, at every point, product over every point. And if I just scale things out, it scales this way with dimensions of the Fierbein. So the basic idea of the method is to fix the meaning of this rather ill-defined quantity by a Gaussian integral and say, I have an inner product on this space, and I'm going to normalize the Gaussian with an I here, so this is all going to be Lorentzian in a way that this just normalizes to 1. So basically, unless I have derivatives of the field, which is what I want, to have dynamics, this is just a trivial integral.
The inner product isn't positive, right?
No, it depends on C.
Right. So I, that's why you got the I. Well, the I.
Yeah. I mean, the I is here because I want to do everything in Lorentzian from the beginning, and so I'm not doing any Euclidean rotation. But it's not in general positive definite.
Yeah. What about volume of the gauge groups?
Yeah, that's coming. That's coming. Okay. So this is exactly what I'm going to talk about. This actually is in this older review article back in 95, if you want to look there for the details, because I have to skip a lot of it. So the basic idea is to decompose the metric deformation, the small deformation of the metric, into essentially a Hodge decomposition in such a way that I can parameterize the gauge orbits. So the gauge orbits are parameterized by a vector field C, which is the local infinitesimal diffeomorphisms at this tangent point in the tangent space. L is defined in this way in order to be, it's of course the gauge transformation of the coordinates, and I take out the trace part and put it back on this side. I didn't have to do it that way, but that's a conventional way of doing it. And then essentially what I'm going to do is change variables from this full metric deformation to the components, H perp, which satisfies some constraint. For example, it could be transverse, hence the notation perp, or you can slice the coordinates in different ways. It doesn't have to be, but that would be an orthogonal decomposition with respect to the inner product we had before. So I write this thing as an integral over these various pieces, over the H perp, over the vector part, which is going to just give me the volume of the gauge group, the diffeomorphisms, and over the scalar or trace part. And so I have to calculate a Jacobian, which will arise from this change of variables. And then the diffeomorphism group is, in a sense, trivially factorized out. It's just cross off this integral over the vector field. Of course, there are subtleties depending on boundary conditions, zero modes, which I'm skipping over here. That has to be treated in a case-by-case basis. But at least formally, if there are no obstructions, this should be a covariant definition of the measure. The Jacobian is, in fact, easily computed. You just have to substitute this thing into the inner product and do a bunch of Gaussian integrals, keep track of the determinant. And if this is defined to be and the orthogonal complement to L, then you get the Hermitian conjugate with respect to the inner product, and J is just this Jacobian. So this is actually a nice way to see why Fadeev, you can do this for gauge fields too, of course, and this is why the connection lies with Fadeev-Popov method, which you may be familiar with. So you can extend this, even though this is defined in the tangent space. There's nothing preventing me in principle from parameterizing all metrics as a diffeomorphism, a conformal transformation on some base metric. So the picture is I have some base space, which is going to be my projected space where I take out the gauge orbit. It's supposed to intersect the gauge orbits only once. That, of course, Neil said to talk about things which are potential problems, that, of course, has to be checked. It's by no means trivial. We know in non-abelian theories that there are obstructions, Gribov ambiguities. So it's quite unknown whether this will always work in gravity and what the obstructions are. But at least formally, it seems like it can extend this over at least some patch away from the local tangent space so that this could be a finite diffeomorphism, a finite conformal transformation. And this is some base point. And then, so formally, you can just carry out this trick, keep track of the Jacobian, and now what you're supposed to do is integrate over the remaining gauge invariant degrees of freedom, which is the G perp and the conformal part, sigma, And by assumption, this applies not only to the Einstein action, but any covariant action is independent of Xi. And so it just depends on, you can strip off the diffeomorphisms, and this is just depending on the diffeomorphic invariant part of it. If you check this in loops, for example, do one loop gravity or even two loops, I believe it's been checked, it does work. So it reproduces, it's a generally covariant definition of a path integral over Lorentzian geometries. I haven't done any discretization. I haven't done any Euclidean continuation. So in principle, this is as defined as some of the path integrals we were hearing about earlier in real time. Of course, in order to really evaluate these determinants, you're going to have to regularize, use something like zeta function or heat kernel, and that's where interesting effects also lie. You understand that the Jacobian's role is to remove the unphysical gauge modes. In fact, you can just count, since L is a vector operator, takes vectors to tensors. L, the Hermitian conjugate, takes tensors back to vectors. So L dagger L lives in the space of vectors. So this is a vector determinant, which means it has roughly four degrees of freedom per point. And because it comes with a plus 1/2, the opposite of what you expect from integrating propagating degrees of freedom, you're basically subtracting 4 degrees of freedom from the 6 which are remaining here. And that gives you the 2 transverse modes if you just carry it through at one loop order. This has been applied to De Sitter and other cases, which I don't have time to talk about, but it's quite interesting. I say here it agrees with the canonical phase space definition. Apparently it does, but I think there are still some interesting issues. For example, in looking at the BRS or Batalin, BFV, I guess it is, Batalin Fadeev-Vilkovsky path integral. Just to make these comparisons and prove these things. But in the cases that we've checked, it does seem to work. And now I come to connection that to what I want to talk about. So this is just all a review, which I'm happy to talk about this even further if you like. There are applications. But what I want to talk about in the rest of the talk is the fact that the covariant definition of the path integral leads to the trace anomaly, and of course, for scalar, for matter fields, this was discussed some time ago by Fujikawa. And I want to remind you about some things about 2D gravity and then go to 4D. Any questions just on this part? This is really an introduction. Yeah.
Are you assuming that there is no boundary for your
space? Yeah, I haven't worried about boundary conditions. Of course, if I apply it to a specific case, then I'm going to have to apply boundary conditions to these differential operators, and the determinant has to be over the appropriate set of functions that satisfy the boundary condition.
I mean, then you have some boundary degrees of freedom because of the...
There could be. There could be in principle, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
David?
Yeah.
Did you say that formula was checked at 2 loops?
Yeah, maybe. I think so, but I have to look. I had it in my memory, but I'm not sure at the moment, so... Let me check that. For one loop, for sure. Yeah. Okay. So now let's try. Okay, we've been talking about formalism. It's very interesting questions at the mathematical level of defining path integrals for a diffeomorphism invariant theory. But I'm kind of impatient, and I want to use this and go on and see what we can get out of it. So a good instructive example is to apply this to 2D gravity. Even more simple than the 3D case we just heard about. So if you were to write down a 2D action, you would presumably write everything up to 2 derivatives, which would include an Einstein-Hilbert-like term and a cosmological term. But you'd quickly realize that this theory is content-free classically because every metric is locally conformal up to boundary terms or topology. Every metric can be written as a conformal deformation of flat space. And correspondingly, the density here, root g times r, is a total derivative. It's a constant that depends on the background, which I could choose to be flat, and Laplacian or D'Alembert operator on sigma. So if I put it in here, it's a surface term. It doesn't give me any equations of motion. So you'd say this theory is overconstrained, doesn't contain any dynamics. However, if I add matter fields to a general 2D metric, then there is a conformal anomaly. And I guess I had a slide, but I skipped it out due to time. But we can go back to exactly that measure that I was defining before. And if you use basically the covariant measure for the matter fields and integrate out the matter fields in a covariant way, then you necessarily get a non-zero trace of the energy momentum tensor. So even if you start with classically conformally invariant matter, the trace of its energy momentum tensor is not zero if you want it to be conserved. So basically an anomaly is a clash between invariance principles. You can't both have conservation and tracelessness. So you give up tracelessness and write the anomaly this way. This coefficient is known to string theorists and Virasoro algebra folks as the central charge. So I write it like this, it's proportional to the number of fields. And because I have this very simple formulas here on this, it's all on one page here, R is linear in sigma, all metrics are conformal to flat locally. So basically, you can just multiply both sides of this by root g and plug in this formula. And you see that you immediately can write down a Vesemino-like action, which this is the first variation of. It's linear in sigma. So obviously, the Vesemino action is quadratic in sigma. And so you can write it down immediately. And it's this, right?
But what it has to do with quantization of gravity? You just take scalar frequency dimension, take positive integral over scalar field, and you are getting this anomaly. It's a given gravitational ground. So
but now sigma is a propagating field. That's my point.
Yes,
so if I put this back into the path integral for gravity, it's going to have different effect, right?
So you mean that you want now to integrate over sigma?
Yeah, eventually. I mean, sigma becomes dynamical. So in the end, you can either do some semi-classical approximation, or you can try to be more ambitious and try to integrate totally over sigma, and that's, of course, essentially Liouville theory.
But in terms of the original field, it's a non-local action.
Well, look, the formulas are here. Just be patient, okay? So it's a local action in terms of sigma,
yes, right.
But it depends on the background. This is the... So in order to interpret this in a covariant way, you could keep it in, this is of course some kind of coordinate slicing or gauge, but you can also run this thing backwards and say, okay, I'll put this on the left-hand side and I'll solve this for sigma by inverting the differential operator here, which is interesting because now non-locality comes in. And then you can write this Vesemino action as basically a finite conformal boost of conformal transformation of a non-local action. So it's literally the difference of this non-local action evaluated at the conformal metric to the original one. And this is the action, which I think was first written down by Polyakov in the early 80s. And here's the non-locality you're talking about, which of course I had to get if I solve for sigma. But now I can do one further step. And I should have mentioned here that, of course, sigma was non-dynamical, the classical theory. But if you look at this form, it's got a kinetic term, right? So no matter what transformations I do on it, it's got to have some kind of dynamics associated with it. And a covariant form, so this might hold you back because it's non-covariant, but you can introduce this non-local transformation, and then rewrite this then again in a local form in terms of a new field phi, which in some sense is along the conformal fiber of the base space of metrics. So here, this phi is not the original matter fields, whatever they were, but it's an effective gravitational degree of freedom, which is propagating, who obeys a first-order equation of motion. If I so obviously, if I vary this quadratic action, I get a linear equation in phi. If I solve for phi formally, I get back to this. Okay, so it's really formally nothing has happened I have to be careful, of course, about boundary conditions and applying this, but I have induced, if you wish, a degree of freedom in the scalar sector of 2D gravity, which I didn't think I had in the first place. So that should be interesting, right? Because that's a massless scalar, which didn't appear in the original part of the spectrum.
Just two sigma? You had an error.
That meant to say it's in the conformal direction. Okay, so basically transformations of phi are related to transformations of sigma, but phi is defined, you see these equations, if I just look below this line, this is completely covariant, doesn't depend on any background, right? This is the total metric, derivative is the total curvature, you know, this is at the physical metric, if you wish. So what I've done is essentially thrown away the reference to the base metric. It's a completely covariant description now. So you can ask yourself, well, what is the scalar? And that in itself is an interesting question. And the way to see it is, for example, to look at stress tensor correlation functions. Go back, if you wish, to your original field theory. This anomaly, after all, came from integrating out, as Slava said, integrating out matter fields. So put a matter field, a fermion, a boson, doesn't matter, whatever you want around here, and compute this stress tensor correlator, in perturbation theory even. And what you find is that conservation, so there's only one momentum running through, one two momentum, and the polarization tensor has to have this form by conservation and the symmetries. Okay. And so what is this thing? This is a scalar polarization part, but the fact that the trace has to be non-zero because I have to get back R tells me that if I trace over one set of these indices, k squared pi of k squared cannot be zero at k squared equals zero. And in fact, do the calculation explicitly, it's not. Okay, so there's a massless boson pole. It means pi of k squared has to behave like 1 over k squared near k squared equals zero. And you can analyze this to your heart's content. You can find, for example, that the bosonic operators, and this is a covariant description, in a canonical description, the bosonic Fock space operators are actually bilinears of the, here they were fermions that went into the underlying theory. So this is something like a two-particle collective state, a very particular linear combination of two-particle modes in one dimension, which assemble up to give a boson. And you can check the canonical commutation relations actually follow from the anomaly.
Amen?
Yeah.
Even if there's no matter, you have the anomaly, and so you have this action. So
Even if there's no matter?
Yeah, if there are no scalar fields whatsoever, say that you put in your two-dimensional theory.
You mean?
We know that the critical case is when you have the number of fields is equal to 26.
Oh, yeah, uh-huh.
And so you have a central charge, basically contribution of minus 26.
Right. Right, that comes from the L dagger L determinant, if I do the Gauss properly.
Various ways of thinking. You still have this kind of structure with the action,
yeah.
But no actual excitation that comes from the matter.
True, you're right. It comes from the determinant or the quantization of the theory. I have this point written here that if you keep track of all the degrees of freedom, in fact, the central charge, which would be minus 26, whatever matter you put in, minus 26, it actually becomes C minus 25. So you can basically think of some part of the matter has gone in to making this collective mode.
But that's what I'm saying. If there's no matter, then how do you get a collective mode from the matter?
Well, you get it as you said from the Gauss determinant. It's always there. It's intrinsically there, and you can of course tune it to zero, which is what people do in string theory, in critical string theory, to cancel the anomaly. But in some sense, that's a special case. So non-critical string theory would generally have this term. You could just think of this as a free constant, if you wish. Okay, forget about where it came from and just treat it as a you know, a constant in Lagrangian. And I would say that's probably a good point of view, because from the point of view of effective field theory, this is a relevant operator in the low energy Lagrangian, and therefore it should have a coefficient which is non-zero in general, just, you know, from Wilsonian-like arguments. So this is, you know, a summary of stuff that people who know this know it. Not everyone does anymore, but basically, this is non-critical string theory. There is a massless pole, and I tend to use the words borrowed from condensed matter physics, because if you look very hard at these amplitudes, which are anomalous, you can see it really is a kind of pairing of fermions, or they don't have to be fermions, but a pairing of, it's a two-particle intermediate state. At the Dirac surface, if you think of them as fermions, and these are at the Dirac C, just like a Cooper pair in condensed matter physics is at the Fermi surface. And, you know, particular combination with opposite momentum.
Again, just to, maybe this is laboring a point, but if C is equal to zero, yeah, what are you pairing? If C is equal to zero, there's no matter to pair.
Okay. Well, there's... Okay, but you know, if I treat the Gauss determinant properly, then there are some other fields running around here, which, you know, I wouldn't mind.
In terms of Gauss,
you could think of that. You could probably think of it that way. Although then, you know, that's not unitary, so you have to add matter, I think, to make it sensible. But okay, I mean, this is an interpretation. You can take it if you like, or not if you don't. But what I'm trying to say here is that this is interesting also, that the commutators are canonical commutators in terms of the boson field. But to those of people who remember the story about bosonization in two dimensions, this is an example of bosonization in which you start with an underlying theory, could be fermionic, and you end up in the description in terms of a new field, which is some kind of composite field, which is a boson. I would say that one should take this into account. Indeed, it does have interesting effects that have been studied analytically and on the lattice. It dresses the critical exponents. So for example, if my underlying theory were an Ising model along the line, the Ising model coefficients are well known at the critical points, but now, letting this couple to gravity is basically letting the lattice fluctuate freely and the critical points change. And that's actually been seen both on lattice simulations and in polymers and systems which seem to lie in the same universality class. So it's for real. I mean, this isn't some trick. This means also, if you think in terms of critical exponents in stat-mech, it's long-distance physics, right? I'm looking at behaviors at critical points when the correlation length is much bigger than any ultraviolet cutoff. So these are the lessons I want to take from 2D and bring to 4D.
So, I hate to speed it up.
But I'm over. I'm out of time, so I'm stuck in 2D.
I wonder.
Yeah.
Whatever
you want. I'll stop whenever you say.
Yeah,
it's a logical stopping point.
Just say, yeah, the same happens in point.
Yeah, I mean, I...
No,
so there is another degree of freedom I want to claim in low energy gravity in 4D. Now, I went through this, you know, pretty slowly, because I know there are people who don't know all this stuff and just wanted to have some common ground. Stop.
Later.
Let's stop.
That's my suggestion.
Okay.
Questions? Yes. Question.
You know, many years ago, at least Romain Jacquive, and I was also interested in this and so on. So instead of looking at higher dimensions, and it was fashionable, we wanted to look at gravity in low dimensions. So then the question was, the gravity in 1 plus 1.
That's what this is. Yeah.
So then one could, there was this Polyakov thing, but one could quickly realize, and you wrote it, that one, and I will speak in Hamiltonian language, but it's the same, I think, that you could have a theory that was, that could be formulated on an arbitrary space-like surface with an arbitrary coordinate on it, so you would call it dangerously generally covariant. In 1 plus 1, the equation of motion of which was the only thing that one would hope for, that the scalar curvature was equal to the trace of the energy momentum of tension.
Yes, I actually know, I know those papers.
Yeah. All right, so, but the trick was the following, that in this theory, you could only vary, as you pointed out, the metric by a Weyl transformation. You could not extremize the action with respect to what one would call the lapse and the shift.
Mm.
So that theory is a theory that can be written down. I think it was the first example of a theory where there was a classical center of charge also, mm-hmm. that then reappeared in 2 plus 1.
Mm-hmm.
So the theory has the same Hamiltonian structure, where the generators obey the same algebra, but then the constraints cannot be imposed.
Mm-hmm. There's an anomaly, a central term.
What?
Right. I mean, it's all understood, right, in terms of Virasoro.
Yeah.
Right.
But don't...
But you don't want that. Okay. All right.
Let's wait until the
next. All right. Let's get to your point.
So the point is the following, that this theory, because you cannot impose the constraints, if you could impose the constraints, the theory would have minus 1 degree of freedom.
Right.
So you cannot impose the minus 5, it has 1 degree of freedom, which is your field. But what I want to emphasize is that the symmetry of the theory that used to be a gauge symmetry, namely, quote, space-time diffeomorphisms, end of quote, has now become a global symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's an important conceptual point. I mean, this theory, although the equation of motion, which is the curvature equals to the trace of the energy momentum tensor, looks invariant under changes of coordinates. It is indeed invariant, but the invariance is a global symmetry. It's as if Maxwell's equations are Lorentz invariant. It's not a gauge symmetry anymore. That's the price paid.
Okay.
That's what I want to.
Okay. I think let's talk some more. I think that's consistent, right? What I said, but maybe I have to understand completely your point of view. I thought there were some papers trying to do this canonically, but I'm not sure they reached a clear answer. So, everything goes through very simply in this covariant language. And of course, the string theory folks all worked out the path integrals very clearly in the covariant method. But I haven't seen a clear canonical treatment of this, which might be interesting.
There might be a trade-off of something that you thought was against symmetry, and at the end it's no longer against symmetry.
Okay, I have to, let's think about that to understand.
I think that the point he's trying to make, if I understand it,
yeah, okay,
is that if you don't have the gauge symmetry, you don't have the freedom of eliminating dangerous degrees of freedom that would be potential ghosts in the theory. Is that correct? Is that what you're trying to say, basically?
I think you're putting words in his mouth, but so, that's it.
I've been thinking about this as you are talking about it.
Okay.
So that's why you need to work at the critical dimension so that you can kill the animals. It's the same theory.
Can I suggest we eat lunch?
I don't.
Let's close the discussion. This has been very interesting.
Okay.
Let's get more.